from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in Forums next hour, with the number of older people increasing, the cost of the healthcare system from fractures and osteoporosis will also inevitably increase. Every 20 seconds, a bone breaks as a result of osteoporosis, which causes the bones in some 10 million Americans to become weak and fragile. In the hour ahead, we focus on osteoporosis and the latest in research, treatment, and prevention, and we'll hear all about a four-decade-old but recently revived controversial theory about diet and osteoporosis. Did your mother tell you to drink your milk to have the calcium needed for strong and not brittle bones? And was she right? And how strong are your bones, and what's the best way to ensure they stay strong? We'll discuss all that and more in the next Forum Hour with your calls and emails after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Osteoporosis, which means porous bones and commonly results in fractures, affects some 10 million Americans, and half of all women over 50 and a quarter of all men over 50 will break a bone due to osteoporosis. In this Forum Hour, we want to focus on osteoporosis and bone strength, as well as on a, well, heated up controversy over what role diet plays. And joining us in studio is Michael Castleman, who is a veteran health writer, co-authored a new book called Building Bone Vitality with Amy Lanoue. And good morning, Michael Castleman.
Good morning, Michael. Thank you.
Glad to have you here. Also glad to have David Karff with us, who is adjunct clinical associate professor of endocrinology at Stanford School of Medicine. Welcome. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael.
And good morning to Laura Schobeck, who is an endocrinologist, professor of medicine at UCSF. Welcome. Glad to have you as well.
Thank you.
Well, let me begin with Michael Castleman, because probably many of you who are listening, like me, heard your mother say over and over again, drink your milk, it'll build your bones, and doctors recommend milk for calcium. The Surgeon General recommends milk for calcium. Are we demythologizing that here?
Everyone says drink milk and take calcium to strengthen your bones. But if you look at the worldwide epidemiology of osteoporosis, what you find is that the countries that consume the most calcium have the highest rates of osteoporotic fracture, not the lowest. Now, I am not against calcium. It's not I'm opposed to calcium. Calcium is an absolutely essential mineral, but it has been vastly oversold for prevention of osteoporosis. The fact is that Americans have one of the highest rates of osteoporotic fracture in the world, and we are one of the highest calcium-consuming nations in the world. Countries in Asia and Africa that consume less than half of the calcium that we consume have osteoporotic fracture rates that are 60 and 70% below ours. So while calcium is an essential nutrient, it is not a panacea for bone health and osteoporosis prevention, even with added vitamin D. There's a better way to prevent osteoporosis.
Calcium and vitamin D are only two of the 17 nutrients, as you point out in your book, really. And vitamin D and calcium get a lot of, maybe too much press, as you put it?
Yes, in my opinion, vitamin D and calcium are presented as a panacea for bone health. But if you look at, there have been 140 studies of dietary approaches to prevention of osteoporotic fracture. And only one-third of them show any benefit for calcium. Two-thirds of them show no benefit. When you add vitamin D, you do get some benefit. You get a reduction in fracture risk of about 20%. And that's significant. However, there are plenty of countries around the world that don't take calcium, don't take supplemental vitamin D, and have fracture rates that are 60 and 70% below ours. So the best that calcium and vitamin D can offer is not very good compared to what is actually possible through diet and other means.
This gets us right to the diet that you advocate, and you say that, well, as you said earlier, epidemiologically, and we'll hear from our two epidemiologists on this perhaps, but the biggest hip fractures are in those nations with the most calcium consumption. They're also in the nations which consume the most protein. And
correct.
That's where you get into protein and acidic consumption, and why you feel, sort of tying it with the last hour, we need to go on the kind of diet that people like Michael Pollan and Dean Ornish, who writes the foreword to your book, are suggesting.
Yes, your mother may have said drink your milk for strong bones, but she also said eat your vegetables. And that advice is very good, not just for osteoporosis prevention, but for prevention of heart disease, cancer, diabetes, obesity, all of the illnesses that are killing Americans and driving our healthcare costs into the stratosphere. Basically, a high-protein diet, one that is where people eat meat and poultry and fish and dairy 2 and 3 and 4 times a day, that is what is hurting America's bones. The National Institutes of Health, the Institute of Medicine all agree that Americans eat about twice as much protein as they really should for good health. And the reason that protein hurts bone is this. Protein is comprised of amino acids. Those amino acids go into the blood when high protein foods are digested. Those amino acids turn the blood slightly more acidic. The blood cannot be slightly more acidic than it needs to be, so it has to neutralize that acid in the blood. Now, if you've ever taken Tums for acid indigestion, Tums is calcium carbonate. The body does the same thing when it has acidic blood. It reaches into bone for calcium carbonate to neutralize the acid in the blood, and then you get a reduction of calcium in the bone. If you do that for a lifetime, you get osteoporosis. Now, plant foods contain protein, but they also contain a lot of alkaline nutrients that neutralize the blood without reaching into the bones for calcium. But high protein foods like steak, meat, chicken, contain an enormous amount of protein and very little alkaline material, so you have to pull calcium out of bone.
Got to have protein for strong bones, though, don't you?
Yes.
But you're saying eat five to eight vegetable servings a day, which seems very difficult for most people to really think.
Protein is certainly essential for bone health, but what the research shows is that if you eat 6 to 8 servings of fruits and vegetables a day and limit your high protein consumption to 1 serving of meat or chicken or fish, you'll be fine in your bones. You'll be fine in your heart. That's basically the Mediterranean diet that the American Heart Association recommends. And the same diet that is beneficial for the heart also turns out to be good for your bones.
And the cancer.
Cancer, too.
American
yes,
cancer
the National
Society makes the same
recommendation. 5 to 8 servings of fruits and vegetables a day, or basically 2 per meal.
Michael Castleman, again, is a health writer. He co-authored a new book, Building Bone Vitality, with Amy Joy Lanoue. And I misspoke, I said epidemiologist. We've got a couple of endocrinologists with us, so forgive me for that. But let me go to you, Dolores Schobeck. The sense of diet and how important it is to osteoporosis prevention is really a lot of what the book by Michael Castleman and Amy Joy Lanoue is all about. And I was under the impression that 95% of bones is calcium, so calcium can't be bad. In fact, it's probably, one would assume, really good.
Right. Calcium is incredibly important in forming a very healthy and strong bone matrix and giving bone the strength to help prevent fractures. So calcium is an incredibly important nutrient in bone, as is vitamin D, which helps the intestine to absorb the calcium that you take in your diet and in the supplements that you take. So calcium is incredibly important. It's a threshold nutrient. That's how I view it. Along with vitamin D, we need to reach a certain level of calcium available to the skeletal system to maintain good bone strength and good bone density.
You saw the piece in this morning's paper, for example, about how 70% of United States children are low in vitamin D. And again, it was linked in the media completely to the sort of thing we're talking about, bone
exactly.
density.
Exactly. There have been many surveys in many countries showing that children who don't get outside or who, when they go outside, are covered or wear sunblock when they're in the sunshine are simply not making enough vitamin D in their skin and not consuming enough in their diets to have adequate vitamin D levels. And there's been a wonderful explosion of research and interest in vitamin D and actually defining what is vitamin D sufficiency for adults and for children, which is really very, very important work and really does inform this discussion.
Well, in terms of informing this discussion, do you think that bone density and bone strength is really tied in specifically? Because I think what we're hearing from Michael Castleman is that the media has overplayed both vitamin D and calcium.
Well, I can't speak for the media, but I can speak for myself and in my recommendations to patients.
Wait, excuse me. I think you also imply in your book, Michael Kessman, I just want to get this on the record, that maybe doctors are not as informed about research as they ought to be, where calcium and vitamin D are concerned.
Well, certainly other guests in the studio this morning are very well informed about bone health, but I think too many physicians just tell patients, make sure you get enough vitamin D and calcium. But in building bone vitality, we demonstrate that that's simply not enough. There are 17 nutrients that are necessary for strong bones. Calcium and vitamin D are two of them, and the other 15 are available largely from plant foods.
Well, let me get you, Dolores, show back on record here, because we talked to actually the program director of the Foundation for Osteoporosis in Oakland, and she strongly disagrees with Mr. Castleman's whole thesis. Do you?
Well, there are several aspects to the thesis, but I certainly think that sufficient calcium and sufficient vitamin D, adequate levels, are necessary for bone health throughout life, childhood, teenage years. After that, once one reaches peak bone mass, and really throughout life, adequate amounts. And it varies at different stages in life and what a person may be going through. But I absolutely feel that those are incredibly important nutrients. As I said, nutrients that I think are threshold nutrients. One needs a sufficient amount, depending on the situation, the age, and so forth, for building and maintaining an adequate skeleton and keeping it strong. Treating, for example, postmenopausal bone loss with calcium or vitamin D isn't sufficient. Treating bone loss that may occur due to certain kinds of medication or being ill and staying in bed or being under rehab or any other conditions, calcium and vitamin D are simply not sufficient in and of themselves to manage those situations. But no one, I think, would feel that you could gain bone or maintain bone without adequate amounts of calcium and vitamin D and prevent fractures due to falls. There's been a lot of work in older patients showing that vitamin D and calcium, and particularly the vitamin D, really are incredibly important for neuromuscular function and coordination and help to prevent falls in older people.
How about high-acid protein diets? As far as the bones are concerned.
I think that certainly the work that you cited, Michael, in your book and research that I've followed for many, many years, a lot coming out of UCSF, Dr. Sebastian, Dr. Selmayr, Dr. Frisetto, Dr. Morris, and so forth, have really championed a shift in our diet from a high-protein, high-salt diet to a diet that is much, much kinder to bone, but I might also add, as Michael has said, also much kinder to maintaining good body weight, cardiovascular disease prevention, type 2 diabetes prevention, and controlling a lot of other risk factors that we as a society face.
Let me get away a little bit from diet for a moment and just ask you about the relationship of bone mass and body mass.
It's a very interesting question, very exciting area. And definitely as body mass increases, those individuals who are heavier, so to speak, tend to have higher bone mineral density and higher bone mass per se. Some of that probably has to do with just the loading on the skeleton that occurs from carrying that extra weight around. We've also found, and it's causing us a great deal of concern, that patients who undergo bariatric surgery and for weight loss to control obesity and its risk factors and its complications also lose bone mass as quickly as they're losing weight. They tie very closely together. So there's a tight connection, whether it's just loading or whether it has to do with the hormones that are coming out of the fat and influencing the bone. There's a very tight relationship between fat and bone. We don't know for sure, but we're very interested in studying it.
Dr. Dolores Schoebeck, again, is an endocrinologist, professor of medicine at UCSF, and Dr. David Karff is adjunct clinical associate professor of endocrinology at Stanford in the School of Medicine there, and longtime researcher in osteoporosis, and runs the clinic pro bono, I should add, at Stanford. And Dr. Karff, let's talk about testing for osteoporosis now. I mean, the bone mass tests are down the line in the future as far as genetics are concerned, but now there's the T-test. Could you explain how this works? T-scores?
Yes, well, the most common test that physicians use to diagnose a patient with osteoporosis would be a bone mass measurement by a technique known as DXA, DEXA. And this reports the patient's bone mass in terms of differences in standard deviations from young normal. So a T-score of one is one standard deviation greater than the average in young normal, and a T-score of minus one is one standard deviation lower. Most physicians are under the impression that the definition of osteoporosis is simply having a low T-score. But it's much more complicated than that. That would be the same as saying that the only thing which affects heart risk is a total cholesterol. Forget what the HDL and LDL is. And so a slender 30-year-old woman could have a T-score of minus 2, for example. And if she has no other risk factors, that could represent her peak bone mass. That could be entirely normal for her. In contrast, a 70-year-old with a T-score of minus 1.6 at the hip and minus 0.9 at the minus 1.6 at the spine and minus 0.9 at the hip, who's been estrogen deficient for 20 years, that could definitely represent osteopenia or osteoporosis. So there is a disconnect between what most physicians think and what is actually the situation. T-scores, the meaning of a T-score differs depending upon the situation.
Dr. David Karp, by the way, I put the F on your name. Forgive me for that.
That's okay.
It's silent. What about risk factors with osteoporosis?
Okay, yeah, I'd like to get into that because—
And diet and how much—
Sure.
That.
So I agree with Michael and with Dr. Schoback that there's really a lot of very compelling data that a more Mediterranean diet is healthier overall. And I think that the diet that is advocated in Michael's book is a fundamentally healthy diet and would have very major impacts on lowering risk factors for heart disease, for example. But I think that it oversimplifies the story as far as dietary protein and bone health. I prefer to come to conclusions based upon actual data. And so citing the geographic incidence of hip fractures is actually very, very misleading, because hip fractures are simply one of the osteoporotic fractures. If you look in the areas where Michael in his book talks about as having the lowest incidence of hip fracture, which is true, Japan, China, Asia, when you look at vertebral fractures, a much more common osteoporotic fracture, they have a very high incidence of vertebral fractures. It totally corresponds to their bone mineral density. And we know why they have a lower incidence of hip fractures, just like we know why the highest incidence is in Scandinavia. It has to do with basically the height. The taller somebody is, the longer basically their femoral neck is. It's easier to
their
snap.
Bodies.
It's easier to snap a longer pencil than a shorter pencil, even though the density of the wood is the same. And the reason for the decreased hip fracture risk in Japan, for example, which is much different than the vertebral fracture risk, is because when those studies were done, the average height was lower, the average hip axis length of the femoral neck, was shorter, and that's why the risk is higher in Scandinavia. And so to do just look across for hip fractures, one can easily be misled and tie it into other factors. Researchers who have really focused on protein intake, people like Bob Haney at Creighton, for example, have done very, very well-done studies which have demonstrated that if your calcium intake is low, if it is insufficient, as you increase the animal protein in the diet, you promote hypercalciuria, losing calcium in the urine. But if you have a higher calcium intake, an adequate calcium intake, there is no relationship between protein intake and bone health, calcium losses in the urine. There were randomized, control, well-done clinical studies done, okay, published in Lancet in 90, in Annals of Internal Medicine in 98, showing that after a hip fracture, if you give protein, if you give supplement the diet with protein, you actually get much significantly better recovery from the hip fracture. You prevent loss of bone mass in the other hip, the non-fractured hip. So it's a bit more complicated than I think Michael's book lays out.
Well, actually, you mentioned Lancet. Michael, in your book, that low acid theory goes back about to an article 40 years ago in Lancet. I guess it didn't get perhaps as widely disseminated as you would have liked to have seen.
Yes, the theory that we're presenting in Building Bone Vitality is not new at all. It was originally articulated in 1968 by researchers who were writing in the Lancet Journal and identified the fact that an ultra-high protein diet, which is what the wealthy, affluent Western countries eat, is giving Americans and Western Europeans heart disease and cancer, and it was also giving them osteoporosis. I think that anyone in your listening audience who's interested in the role of diet in osteoporosis can just go to our website, buildingbonevitality.com, read the argument, and decide for yourself. You know, how people eat, it's up to them. I'm not going to get on a soapbox and say you absolutely must eat this way. People make their own eating decisions, but those eating decisions have consequences. And when people eat a very high meat and high animal protein diet, it's bad for overall health. It's bad for your heart. It increases risk of cancer, and it vastly increases risk of osteoporosis. When you eat fruits and vegetables, and it really doesn't even matter which ones, just eat the ones you like. If you eat,
you don't get much calcium in fruit, though, do you?
There's plenty of calcium in plant foods. There's plenty of calcium in plant foods. In fact, in Asian countries, people eat no dairy after weaning. They breastfeed, and then you go to a Chinese restaurant. There's no milk. There's no cheese. And yet in China, people have lower risk of hip fracture than we do here. Now, some of that has to do with exercise. And another critical part of osteoporosis prevention is walking or weight-bearing exercise 30 to 60 minutes a day. And I think everyone, no matter how you feel about dietary approaches to osteoporosis prevention, everyone agrees that weight-bearing exercise is necessary. But in our view, in Building Bone Vitality, we believe that a high dairy food diet, milk, cheese, yogurt, has been vastly oversold as a means to prevent osteoporosis. And what would really help is if people ate more fruits and vegetables.
Well, that's the essence of your book. And that's certainly, as I said, in concert with the ideas that are been put forward by most health practitioners in terms of what's healthy, by people like Michael Pollan, whom we said before. But I guess we get down to the nub of an argument here, Dr. Schobeck, of whether or not you're depriving your bones and your tissues of what's needed for health if you're putting too much emphasis, let's say, on de-escalating the protein and having all these vegetables and fruits in your diet.
Well, I hope that your diet would not remove protein completely, and certainly we need protein. You can certainly make protein, but it certainly makes it easier to provide protein and amino acids to then synthesize the components of your cells that you need. I think your diet would certainly involve an emphasis on more fruits and vegetables, reducing the protein, but not eliminating it completely. And I would recommend that there be adequate calcium provided either through a simple supplement or through actually some dairy products. Not all of the calcium that's in fruit and vegetables is bioavailable, and particularly in older patients where there may be absorption issues. The bioavailability of all plant calcium isn't equal in all individuals.
Well, when do you need, Dr. Karp, when do you need supplements, calcium supplements or vitamin D supplements, particularly in terms of what we're talking about, prevention of osteoporosis?
Well, that's actually a very, very key question, Michael. The recommendation now is for people that are in a high turnover state, such as women after menopause, for example, to have total intake of around 1,200 to maybe 1,500 milligrams of calcium a day. But what needs to be recognized is this is total intake of calcium. What I see in the clinic that I run at Stanford very commonly is that physicians will know that you need to get this amount of calcium, but they'll neglect to count how much calcium the person is getting from their diet. And I'll see patients who are, you know, having a yogurt a day and a couple of slices of cheese and some milk, who don't actually need any extra calcium.
We need to go to break, so I want to give out the phone number. I know there are a lot of people with questions and who would like to join this discussion. Please feel free to do that now. It's toll-free, 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls. Again, toll-free from anywhere, 866-733-6786, or send us an email, forum@kqed.org. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, and over 10 million Americans suffer from osteoporosis. It causes bones to become weak and brittle, and we're finding out all about the disease in this hour and also about theories related to diet and prevention. Talking with Michael Castleman, co-author of Building Bone Vitality, and also a veteran in the health journalism field. We're talking with David Carr, who's here in studio with us, adjunct clinical associate professor. All of our guests are in studio this morning. Of endocrinology at Stanford, who runs the clinic on osteoporosis at Stanford, and Dolores Schobeck. Dr. Schobeck is professor of medicine at UCSF and an endocrinologist. We're going to go to your calls here in just a moment. Before we do, though, Dr. Carb, you want to say something about vitamin D and new studies, again, new research in terms of vitamin D and its relationship to the skeleton?
Well, actually, it's the benefits outside the skeleton.
I mean, excuse me, outside
so,
the skeleton.
So new, I'm not sure about new, but over the past 10 years, there have been a number of quite well-done studies which have demonstrated that even though vitamin D is very important for bone health, and yet you really need to have a value of about 30 nanograms per mil for those that are technical to protect the skeleton, that studies that have looked at patients getting higher in the optimal range, values of 50 or 60 compared to lower, have shown a number of benefits, including improvements in immune function, decreased risk of type 2 diabetes, Alzheimer's disease, and cardiovascular disease, as well as a significant decrease in at least four malignancies, prostate cancer, cancer of the colon, breast, and malignant melanoma. And so we know that there are vitamin D receptors on many, many tissues outside the intestine. We know that vitamin D has very important immune functions, and vitamin D is important for many aspects of health outside of the skeleton.
Now, this is good to hear. Since my physician, my internist, has been telling me to pop a lot more vitamin D, and I have been. But Michael Kesselman, you're not gainsaying any of that, are you?
No. Like I said, my co-author and I are not opposed to people eating calcium in their diet. We're not opposed to people taking supplemental vitamin D. We are just saying that health authorities have exhorted Americans to increase their calcium consumption for 30 years now to prevent osteoporosis. And what do we have? We have an osteoporosis epidemic. Calcium and vitamin D are not the only answers. If you look at the medical literature, in fact, many of these studies were done right here at UCSF. It is a Mediterranean diet, one that is high in fruits and vegetables, that is critical to preventing bone loss and osteoporosis. And you get plenty of calcium in a high fruit and vegetable diet. You get and by exercising outdoors, taking walks, you get lots of vitamin D. And in addition to that, if you have two servings of fruits and vegetables per meal, you are preventing not only osteoporosis, but heart disease, cancer, diabetes, obesity, and Alzheimer's disease. It's what your mother told you to do. Do what mom said. Eat those fruits and vegetables.
She also told me drink a glass of milk with every meal, though. Now, we're going against mom here. But Dolores Schobeck, let's get you on record here before we bring our callers in. Because of those studies at UCSF that Michael Kesselman alluded to?
Yes, I do know that work well, and I do certainly agree that high protein in the diet does have effects on urinary calcium. But if sufficient calcium is provided, fluxing through the system, and none of this is excessive, we should be fine. It needs to be provided in the diet.
We'll go to our callers, and we'll welcome Lisa as our first caller. Good morning.
Good morning. My question is, what's the role of resistance or weight training in the prevention of osteoporosis?
Dr. Carr?
There have been so one of the worst things that anyone can do for their skeleton is to totally unload it. So zero gravity is the worst. Prolonged bed rest immobilization, the rates of bone loss and the increased risk of fracture exceeds even that with high-dose steroids. So that's terrible. It turns out that one needs activities of daily living to basically prevent those untoward consequences. A number of studies have demonstrated if you take older adults, including postmenopausal women, and put them on a really pretty rigorous training program of weight-bearing activity, weightlifting, you can get, in a number of these studies, significant increases, modest but significant, in bone mineral density. But as soon as you stop that level of loading, it's basically a use-it or lose-it phenomena, it'll go back down. The body is very good at homeostatically controlling how much is used. So activities, people should think, as bad as osteoporosis is, the biggest killer of men and women is heart disease. So kudos to a Mediterranean diet when Michael says decreasing the animal protein and fat in the diet, increasing the vegetables, a darn good idea for your overall health, as is exercise to lower risk of heart disease. For preventing fractures, activities that are more related to increasing coordination, things like, you know, Tai Chi or yoga and preventing falls would probably be more valuable than hitting the iron at the gym.
And Dolores Schobeck, Dr. Karp mentions postmenopausal women, and of course they're the most susceptible to osteoporosis. What about the role of estrogen? Because it regulates bone turnover.
Estrogen is incredibly important, and estrogen deficiency is really at the center of why women lose so much bone mass as they begin going through menopause and as menopause continues. And that is the highest rate of bone loss for women in their entire lifespan. So estrogen's incredibly important.
We'll go to more of our callers. Joan, good morning.
Good morning. I wanted to ask about the value of Forteo, which has been suggested for me. I presumably am at high risk for breakage. I've already broken a couple of vertebrae, and I had taken tamoxifen for breast cancer a few years ago. So my estrogen level is probably non-existent, and Forteo has been suggested. Could you comment on its use and its pros and cons?
Dr. Schobeck.
Forteo, for other listeners who may not know that trade name, is parathyroid hormone, a fragment of parathyroid hormone 1 to 34. It's made in the laboratory, but it's a hormone that is normally synthesized in the parathyroid glands in our body. And what's been appreciated over the years is that small doses given once a day, so intermittent dosing of this fragment of parathyroid hormone to women and to men with osteoporosis and fractures will build up bone mass very rapidly. So Forteo, or parathyroid hormone, is an anabolic agent for the skeleton. It just doesn't prevent loss. It actually builds up new bone. And so patients who've suffered several spinal fractures are good candidates for experiencing the benefits of Forteo.
Here's a kind of related question from a listener named Joyce up in Petaluma. She says, I hope there's a chance that you could mention the effect of medication on bones, specifically chemo, tamoxifen, etc.
So the effects of chemotherapy on bone really does depend on the agent. Tamoxifen, for example, is an estrogen antagonist, so it will have some estrogenic activity, but is not the full agonist in the skeleton the way estrogen is. It does have partial protection, but not complete. And other chemotherapy agents, depending on what they are, may have effects on other aspects of sort of overall skeletal health. It would depend on the agent and the disorder.
You want to say something, Dr. Kahn?
Yes, if I could add to that. I agree with Dolores. I mean, she's correct. Tamoxifen actually has... It is not as effective as full-dose estrogen on the bone, but it is actually beneficial on the bone. Drugs that are used also commonly for breast cancer called aromatase inhibitors, which really lower estrogen, they have a much more deleterious effect on the skeleton. And because it's lowering estrogen, which is increasing the rate of bone turnover, the therapies that are mostly used to treat that are agents which decrease and normalize the rate of bone turnover. Estrogen does that. You would never use estrogen in a woman in breast cancer, but the bisphosphonates, for example, would be effective in that setting.
If I may, there's a whole chapter in Building Bone Vitality. We have a whole chapter in Building Bone Vitality that discusses all of the drugs that are used to treat osteoporosis. And it's not that we're against them. We present a sort of consumer's guide to all of the drugs that are used, and for women who
largely informational,
extremely low bone density, anyone who has a history of a fracture is a good candidate for these medications. But there are a lot of them, and they're a little confusing. And so that's why we put this whole chapter in Building Bone Vitality, discussing all the drugs and how good they are and their side effects, etc.
I have a question for you specifically from a listener named Denise, Michael. Your guest recommends eating 5 to 8 servings of fruits and vegetables per day. Could he define serving? What does it mean to eat 5 to 8 servings per day? If I have a peach with toast for breakfast, a cheese and tomato sandwich for lunch, and another peach, it's peach season after all, and pasta with broccoli for dinner or a salad, does that amount to 5 to 8 servings?
Excellent question. A serving is one piece of fruit, so one apple, one peach, one pear, one plum, one orange, or approximately a half a cup of anything else. So, if you have a pasta dish with a tomato sauce, tomato vegetable sauce, that's a serving. Pretty much what fills up a sandwich plate is a serving. And if you have 2 servings of fruits and vegetables with every meal. You'll be getting 6 servings a day, and that is the beginning of a healthy, balanced diet.
Aren't you also saying that bone health really begins in the bloodstream?
Well, yeah, that's our argument because of the acid-base balance in the blood. Remember I mentioned that protein is composed of amino acids. That goes into the blood, makes the blood a little more acidic. If you eat a lot of protein, particularly animal protein, which does not have the natural alkaline buffers that plant foods have.
Alkaline being good for bone health, like raisins, for example. Yeah,
alkaline is good for bone health, and fruits and vegetables are filled with alkaline nutrients. If you have acid, if you have blood that is slightly too acidic, the body has to neutralize that, and the way the body does it is it reaches into bone for calcium.
Yeah, well, my mother told me to eat raisins for iron, too, so we're back to mom. This is a listener, Sandra in Woodside, who says, I'm a female bodybuilder. I take a daily calcium supplement, 600 milligrams in vitamin D and magnesium, but I also consume 150 to 200 grams of protein per day. Also consume about 1 pound of vegetables per day and as much alkaline food as possible. I just heard your guest state that high-protein diet, American diet, is bad for bones. Is my increased protein intake hurting my bones?
If I could...
David Karp?
I think that what the studies show is that if her calcium intake is sufficient, then it probably is not, and it's very easy to check. She can just do a fasting calcium creatinine ratio, and if her value is less than 0.2, then she is not hypercalciuric, and it's probably not having any untoward effect. If her value is certainly above 0.23, or even getting above 0.2, I would do a 24-hour urine calcium. If she's putting out more than 250 milligrams of calcium, there may be some reason to either cut back on her protein or increase her calcium intake. But as long as her calcium intake is sufficient, the data suggests she's not having an untoward effect on her skeleton.
Dr. Schoebeck, you had something?
I tend to agree with that. I think probably with all the exercise that this caller is is doing, she may be counteracting any effects of slightly higher protein intake if she truly is bodybuilding.
And Michael Castleman?
I would agree with the doctors. It's not that protein is bad. Osteoporosis is based on a question of balance. Balancing a certain amount of protein, which is essential for health and for bone health, against fruits and vegetables. Americans don't eat fruits and vegetables. In fact, the latest national federal survey, the NHANES, just showed that in the last 20 years, Americans' average fruit and vegetable consumption is down by about 30%. I mean, Americans eat fewer fruits and vegetables today than our parents and grandparents did. And I don't think it's any coincidence that we have a lot more hip fractures than they had.
And we go to more calls from Vallejo. Dana, thank you for waiting. You're on forum. Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning. My background is I'm a clinical nutritionist with a master's degree in clinical nutrition and a collateral in exercise physiology, and I've been a competitive bodybuilder for 30 years. Now, I've also worked with skilled nursing patients, and what I can tell you is this. Anytime physical activity stops, for instance, in a skilled nursing unit, my patients can't get out of bed. And if they can't get out of bed, they become hypercalcemic. Calcium leaves the bones, enters the bloodstream, and many of my patients become confused as a result. To the degree that I can incorporate physical therapists to walk them daily, we can reverse that. The second point I wanted to make as a nutritionist is one thing that your guest has not taken into account. People on high-protein diets often don't eat enough fruits and vegetables. So it's not that the diet is high-protein. It has to do with the fact that many athletes focus too much on the meat, and therefore they don't take in enough fruits and vegetables. Especially non-starchy vegetables and cruciferous vegetables. My third point is that many Americans consume huge quantities of Coca-Cola and sodas, which are very high in phosphorus. And the excess phosphorus taken in robs the body of calcium. And then my last point is I worked 7 years strictly with gastric bypass patients. We measured vitamin D level, 25-hydroxycholecalciferol, before surgery and at markers after surgery. And what happens is the gastric bypass patient malabsorbs fat-soluble vitamins A, D, E, and K. And I've actually had patients not treated with vitamin C and calcium whose teeth would shatter. These are patients of mine that I took from another practice, and therefore they, if they had a nutritionist following their gastric bypass, this could have been averted.
Dana, I'll take points 1 and 4 as editorial, but I'm interested in the two inner points there and get some response from you, Michael Castleman, about the notion, which seems perfectly plausible. A lot of people who are high meat dieting or having a diet with high meat are perhaps just not eating as many vegetables because they're eating a lot of meat.
Absolutely. I love every word this caller has said. She should be a guest on Forum, I think.
What about the soda pop, too? She's right about that, isn't
yeah,
she?
Yeah. An American diet, a McDonald's diet, hamburger, fries, and a Coke. That is a diet that's going to give you cancer, heart disease, and osteoporosis if you eat that regularly every day.
Boy, McDonald's could do a wondrous job by perhaps saying, well, you're going to have Big Macs now with broccoli or something along those lines, but I'm afraid that that's...
Well, they're trying.
They have salads, but they don't have vegetables. Yeah, you're going to say, I don't think. It's been a long time since I've been at McDonald's. Dolores, you're...
What I'd like to say, though, that is often children eating that McDonald's meal that you described. And the substitution of the cola for a glass of milk is another issue in childhood bone health. It's a very significant issue. It's the substitution often of the cola for something that's better.
During a period of time when their skeletons are growing at the greatest rate they will ever grow, and the need for calcium
crucial.
Is actually the greatest.
Here's Claudia, who writes, thank you for having Michael Castleman on your show. Dr. Lanoue's work has also focused on teenage girls and bone health. There are at least 26 studies on building bones in teenage girls, and she found that the best indicator of strong bones is that the girls engaged in exercise. Our fixation with high-protein, dairy-heavy diets has created our osteoporosis problem. Animal protein causes an acidic condition in our bodies, and cheese and dairy are the most acid-causing foods that we eat. We really need to move away from believing that cow's milk is a link to protecting our bones. So that's just a comment. But what I'm interested in there is, as I said, we talked to the program director of the Foundation for Osteoporosis, and she said that if you could get kids, especially girls, I imagine, between the ages of 8 to 18, to be aware of how important what we're talking about is here, you could maybe do away with osteoporosis in a generation. I mean, that sounded pretty sweeping to me, but then I thought, how important public education is, right?
That recommendation is entirely data-based, and it would do very good things for bone health. Just one caveat, which is that even if one maximizes their peak bone mass, when you add an important, major insult like removing estrogen, which happens to all women, you wouldn't be getting rid of osteoporosis altogether simply by improving diet, but it would certainly make a big impact.
You want to say something, Dr. Schobeck?
What I'll say is that it's, and I will quote a pediatrician, osteoporosis is a pediatric disease with geriatric consequences. It really has so much to do with the peak bone mass that a child, and we're particularly worried about young and teenage girls, the Diet Coke epidemic in this country and so forth, but it really is a disease that the groundwork is laid in childhood.
Are you also in favor, particularly in light of this new study of 70% of U.S. children being low in vitamin D, of starting vitamin D at an early age? Enhancing vitamin D? I mean, even with supplements?
I think that certainly that is a very important issue for the pediatric community to address.
And one
how
way to
get
do it,
vitamin D.
One way to do it is just send kids outside to play. The exposure to the sunlight creates vitamin D. One of the problems with kids today is they don't get exercise, and a lot of times they do it indoors if they do it at all. Kids used to go out and play. That's what we should encourage.
Well, here's a listener, Lauren, who writes, U.S. standards for D are far too low. Half a cup of water is no better than a teaspoon of water to put out a kitchen fire. Farmers and lifeguards who make their own D from sunlight are the gold standard, and they have 100%, what is it, NG over M, capital
nanograms
L?
Nanograms per mil.
Yeah, in their D in their blood. But FDA standards for normal is 32 of that, less than a third of the healthy farmers. Enough vitamin D increases calcium absorption by a factor of 20. That would explain why some D in the diet lowers fractures by 20%. It would probably be much higher if people actually got enough D. That's a listener who is involved in a food enterprise. Let me go to more of your calls here. Judy, join us. Hi.
Oh, good morning, and thank you for taking my call.
Thank you.
I wanted to discuss two things. First of all, my diet's been excellent for decades. I eat abundant vegetables, abundant fruit, and only one serving of protein a day. It's aligned with what Michael Castleman has written about. And I also have been a long-distance runner, and I walk all the time. And yet I have unfortunately gotten osteoporosis, even with this healthy lifestyle. And my doctor attributes it to my thyroid. I've taken thyroid medication for over 40 years. And somehow, sometimes we can't balance my levels. My TSH is suppressed. That's the thyroid stimulating hormone. And somehow that we're attributing that to having, you know, taken the bone. And also another exciting development in Europe, and this was written up in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2004, is there's a natural, I think it's a mineral, strontium ranilate, and ranilate is the specific salt that they form from the strontium.
Strontium, like strontium 90?
Yeah, it's actually the real strontium. It's and this is a specific form of strontium that they've developed, doctors have developed in France, and they have had exciting results with it building building back bone mass and healthy bone mass in postmenopausal women. They've done pretty exciting medical studies on that.
Our two medical professors are nodding their head and acknowledging that this has
wish we could get that here.
Well, yeah, one caveat, though, is that strontium is much denser, a heavier metal than calcium. And so the actual fracture efficacy of the studies is not as great as with other agents. BMD seems to go up more, but there's a confound because of the strontium in the bone.
But this is quite promising. I hadn't heard anything about this.
It is indeed, and it is approved in Europe.
And Dr. Schobeck, a number of listeners have been calling in and wanting to know why it happens to us as we age. That is, what mechanism makes us lose bone density?
Well, I think it's really a multifactorial a series of events. Perhaps low peak bone mass is one part of it, and that may be impacted by diet in childhood, activity in childhood, body weight in childhood, many other things. The genes are incredibly important. The age of menopause for women, whether women had normal menstrual cycles throughout their reproductive years or not, whether they were estrogen deficient at any point in time, drugs that we have that we take for various conditions that we acquire through the course of our lives. We haven't said anything about smoking and alcohol, two habits that are hopefully decreasing in their frequency, particularly smoking in our population, but certainly are not at the zero level, and alcohol intake are very important. Then as we age, our ability to absorb calcium and absorb vitamin D and other important nutrients that Michael brings out in his book actually decreases the intestine ages, and its capacity to do its job weakens with age. And so that's probably playing a role as well.
Yeah, this listener who started off the last email I read saying consuming calcium is different than absorbing it in the subject line of her email also says to conclude things, Michael Castleman, I agree that milk is overrated and that we eat too much protein. Could it be that those countries with lower fracture rates are places with more sun exposure and more consumption of fish, a D-rich food?
That has been one of the theories, but it turns out that if you look, there are plenty of countries that have a lot of sun but also have high fracture rates. Israel is one of them. Israel has has one of the highest osteoporotic fracture rates in the world, and yet it's very sunny. And the reason, I believe, has to do with the fact that it's basically an affluent country where people can afford to eat a very high protein diet. And countries right on the same latitude as Israel that eat a lower protein, less animal food, have lower rates of osteoporotic fracture.
Another listener says, please don't neglect the importance of vitamin K2, found almost exclusively in healthy animal fat. Vitamin K2 directs calcium into bones and out of soft tissue like arteries. We go to more calls, and we welcome David. David, thanks for waiting. You're on.
Hi, thanks so much. I just wanted to say anecdotally that I have been a vegetarian and virtually vegan, no animal products, for 24 years. I'm a professional athlete, and I fight full contact, and I've never broken a bone. I am current world champion in my age division in the fighting system that I do. And
excuse me, David. My mother would also say you shouldn't say that because it's going to bring bad luck to you. I hope that's not the case. You're talking about my mother this hour.
What I do is skill and not luck, I think, more. But the truth is, it astounds me that with all the research coming from all these different directions talking about reducing animal protein and moving more towards a vegetarian diet, that I continually come up with people who just believe that you have to eat lots and lots of meat to be a healthy athlete. And it's just not been borne out by my experience or any of the experience of my professional fighters.
Some thoughts.
Amen.
Well, amen, he says.
If someone is in the act of building muscle, which is protein, then you need to actually have protein. It doesn't have to be from animal sources. There are plant sources, legumes, could be rich sources of protein as well. But I would not recommend someone try to actually bulk up with muscle, weightlifting, and have a diet that is very, very low in protein. Not pushing. Again, the bottom line and the take home, I think, for people is that Michael's point that a diet that is lower in animal fat and higher in vegetables and fruits is healthy. No argument at all. That's absolutely true. The difference, I think, is the role of that on bone health.
I heard Tina directing here saying, "Meyer, tofu? What about tofu in this context?"
Well, soy milk actually comes now supplemented with calcium, and so folks that don't like dairy but do have soy milk, if they are not getting sufficient calcium in their diet, they can get an extra 300 milligrams per cup if they have the supplemented soy milk.
Well, we've certainly learned a lot about bone density and diet and osteoporosis in this hour, and I want to thank all of our guests. Dr. David Karp, again, is Adjunct Clinical Associate Professor of Endocrinology with the Stanford University School of Medicine. Thank you for being with us.
My pleasure, Michael.
And I thank you, Dr. Dolores Schobeck, who is Endocrinologist and Professor of Medicine, University of California, San Francisco.
Thank you.
And our thanks to Michael Castleman, longtime health writer and co-author of the new book, Building Bone Vitality, with Amy Leneau. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Michael.
And thank you, our listeners. We are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. Wouldn't be here without you, so we appreciate your listenership. An hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. Remind you, you can always let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum or suggest programming ideas to us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or calling our listener call-in response line at 415-553-3300. Our thanks to Dan Zoll, who was our senior editor, to our producers, Kevin Guillory, Tina Lauerberg, and Judy Campbell, to our engineer, Danny Bringer, and our executive producer, Raul Ramirez. For all of us at KQED Public Radio, thanks again for listening. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.